Welcome to Talk Poverty Radio on the WEACT Radio Network. I'm Rebecca Vallis.
And I'm Tracy Ross. And we're joined by a very special guest today from Media Matters for America.
Have you ever noticed that all of our guests are very special, Tracy?
We don't have unspecial people on this show.
We do. We always use the word very special when we... Anyway, Craig, you actually are very special.
I don't quite believe that now.
We've diluted our praise inadvertently with you in the studio. Well, we are very excited to have you here today.
We have a very mediocre guest today, Craig from Media Matters for America.
Well, don't start it off that way because we want him to come back. Craig Harrington is the economic director at Media Matters for America. We are really excited to have him here to talk with us a little bit about what's going on in Greece. And more importantly, perhaps for purposes of Talk Poverty Radio, why the media coverage of Greece matters for purposes of poverty.
Sure. So at Media Matters, what we've done over the last several years is we've tracked a number of instances when conservative media and mainstream media have used Greece, which has been in an economic decline and really a tailspin since 2010. They've used Greece as an example, as a warning, as a canary in the coal mine, warning that the United States, with its own national debt, with its own fiscal deficits in annual budget and expenditures, that the United States was headed on a path toward Greece and that the United States was on the verge of fiscal, financial, and economic collapse, similar to Greece, unless we instituted the sort of austere policy measures that are required to bring the budget into balance and to begin paying down the national debt. The great irony in this is not just the warning that the United States could become synonymous with a country with an economy the size of Connecticut, but also the fact that Greece has instituted the exact types of austere spending cuts and tax increases and privatization measures. They have already done these draconian austerity measures, and it has made their economy worse. So the media for the last several years has been talking out of both sides of its mouth, both demanding the austerity and warning that the United States was on the verge of becoming Greece itself, while ignoring the fact that our economy has actually been recovering for 5 or 6 years consecutively, and ignoring the impact that those austerity measures have on Greece.
So I read a couple of the pieces that you put out pointing out that this is apples and oranges. We can't compare this. We have a very different economy. We're able to, for instance, print off more money, whereas Greece can't produce more heroes when it needs more. So have any of the Fox News pundits been challenged? You know, I haven't seen anything where anyone has said, look, there are austerity measures in place. This isn't working. I haven't seen that.
Well, there have been a few instances when actual economists are able to make it into the Fox News and Fox Business Network echo chamber, and they've engaged in arguments with Fox personalities, and they always find themselves at some sort of crossroads. Austin Goolsbee, who used to work in the Obama administration and is an award-winning economist at the University of Chicago, he's also a regular on Fox Business Network. And for years, while they are complaining that the U.S. is on the verge of becoming Greece, Austin Goolsbee has said, no, we're not, and we can't be, and here are all the reasons. And they simply disagree with him. In fact, on July 8th, we put together a list in 2010, 2011, 2012, 2013, 2014, 2015, six straight years.
Sounds a lot more dramatic when you list all the years, though. I think you should do that again.
Six consecutive years of Fox personalities saying that we were on the verge of becoming Greece, saying that it could happen in the next 3 years, in the next 5 years, in the next 10 years, in the next 25 years, the U.S. was going to become Greece. And every time their predictions have fallen flat, and every single time they continue with this prediction, they just move the goalposts. They move the fences further back. Whenever they claim the U.S. is going to become Greece a la 2013 and 2014 roll through, and the U.S. hasn't become Greece, and they say, well, it's on the verge of happening. It'll happen in 2016. It'll happen in 2025. And it doesn't matter that their predictions are wrong. It doesn't matter that economists say that their predictions are impossible, because they just don't care. And in fact, one Fox News personality, we tweeted out our July 8th piece saying Fox has spent 5 years warning the U.S. was going to become Greece. And one Fox News personality, Charles Gasparino, retweeted it, saying thanks. And we were like, We were like, Charlie, it was meant to mock you. You're an idiot.
Proving that no one actually opens links on Twitter.
Right. And he just sort of sent that out saying, thanks, guys. I have been saying that.
That's amazing.
That's the point we're at with Fox News. Fox is a PR outlet of the Republican Party. They are supposed to do this. They're supposed to undermine the president's economy and his economic message. They're supposed to make the world look like a scarier and more dangerous place than it really is. That's their job, and they do it really well. But they're just immune to facts, and Greece is one example of that.
But it's not just Fox and the right-wing media enterprise, right? It's also USA Today and others that I think people would probably view as more mainstream publications.
Yeah, this is something that Paul Krugman and a number of other people have qualified as very serious person syndrome. And in order to be considered a very serious person in Washington, D.C., you have to say, hey, the debt is a problem, the deficit is a problem. We all agree, air quotes, that Social Security and Medicare have to be cut or retirement ages have to be increased. And one of the specific examples, also on July 8th, Media Matters published a blog pushing back on an op-ed from USA Today. USA Today is the most widely read newspaper in the country. It circulates 2.3 million units every day. And their editors were saying that the United States was on the verge of becoming Greece. And they're saying, look, the debt spiral, the fiscal crisis, the protests in the street, the rioting that we see in Greece, that is coming to the United States. And they said it was coming in a decade unless we started cutting public pensions, started cutting retirement benefits, started cutting national health care benefits. And this, of course, ignores that Greece did these things and it made their economic situation worse. And it also... It's a cartoonish parody of the ridiculous rhetoric that we get out of the right wing. This USA Today article could have been posted on Breitbart.com. It could have been posted on FoxNews.com. And it's indistinguishable from the right wing talking points that we've become so accustomed to. But everyone just internalizes them because they want to be taken seriously.
And we increasingly see, though, that the American public understands that minimum wage raises are important, that overtime compensation is important. So it seems like the public isn't really buying the message that we need to just be concentrating on the debt. Or do I have the take wrong?
Well, in our economic indicator tracking that we've been doing at Media Matters for almost 3 years now, we have found that conversations about the debt and deficit have fallen off considerably. There was a time when even President Obama was talking as a very serious person about the national debt and about the fiscal deficit. But then we brought those things down. The United States reduced its deficit faster than it had ever done in history by larger nominal amounts than ever before in history, and is on track to continue paying it down and continue reducing the size of the deficit for 7 straight years. So President Obama had a larger deficit, had deficit growth from his first year to his second year while we were instituting all of these programs to arrest the financial and economic crisis that he inherited from the Bush administration. But every year since then, 2011 through 2016 in projections, the deficits are going to decrease. The United States did bring its deficits under control, and the national debt has continued to grow, but the rate of increase has reduced far within a sustainable bound. We have a sustainable debt projection into the 2030s and 2040s at this point. It's not a problem for this generation to worry about anymore, and the conversation about it has really fallen off in the media space. Which is why this USA Today editorial was so interesting, because this sort of came out of nowhere. This isn't 2010 or 11 anymore when you could say that the sky was falling. One of the reasons I think that the conversation has fallen off in the media is just that when you make false predictions, normal people, average people, catch on to it. Fox News viewers apparently don't mind that Fox is just wrong and that their business analysts are just wrong.
Kind of comes with the yeah. territory if you're a Fox viewer. Clearly, you're right. You're okay with that.
But you're
it's a prerequisite.
Your average thinking person out there in the world is noticing that that the Fox News punditry, the right wing punditry that has been crying that the sky was falling since President Obama took office. They've noticed that the sky hasn't fallen and the economy actually has gotten better. Obviously, there are things that we can do. There are progressive policies that you can institute. There are jobs programs and investments and certain types of tax structures and revenue streams that you could institute to make the economy better. But the economy is growing consistently. We've produced private sector jobs for like 60 consecutive months, almost 60 consecutive months. I think it's 57 straight months at this point. the economy's doing okay. People want it to do better, and they're irritated about how slow the recovery has been. But it has been a gradual recovery, and it's undeniable. So when you say that that the United States is on the verge of becoming Greece or on the verge of becoming any number of catastrophes, and then those things don't happen, people stop taking you seriously.
So facts being stubborn things, maybe let's step a little bit back from the facts and talk a little bit about what we think is behind these kinds of misinformation campaigns. You mentioned a little bit the link to it's not just calling for cuts. It's not just saying, oh, we can't afford spending. There are specific things that the folks who like to perpetuate these kinds of narratives would like to see cut, right? And it's not the estate tax, right? It's not defense spending. It's Social Security. It's Medicaid. It's food stamps, right? It's spending that really benefits struggling individuals and Americans much more broadly, but when they're in their time of need. So maybe, you know, talk a little bit about what you think is behind pushing this narrative and whether you think it has the risk of being effective.
Well, in a lot of ways, it does feel like it's the same conservative war on the social safety net that we've always seen. President Eisenhower remarked, the quote is maybe apocryphal at this point, but he says that anyone who tries to cut Social Security sort of damns their political party to annihilation. The Social Security is the third rail of American politics. It's not something that Americans are willing to give up, but it's still something that the conservative policy infrastructure wants to cut, that it never wanted to institute it, and it has always tried to root it out, and they're unsuccessful. And the only way that you can get average Americans to give away tens of thousands of dollars of their earned retirement income, income that they paid for, that they invested in, the only way you can convince them to give these things up is by terrifying them. And that's why the rhetoric reaches such a fever pitch, is because they don't want Social Security. It's not that Social Security has funding problems. They simply don't want it to exist, and that's why they target it. When we talk about the national debt and the deficits and becoming Greece and ballooning 30 and 40-year deficit projections, no one ever talks about raising income taxes or actually instituting corporate income taxes, reinstituting them. They virtually don't exist for many companies, many highly profitable companies.
Cuts are the only option.
Yeah,
right? Revenue has been off the table for so long that the only way we could possibly deal with these scary debts and deficits is cuts.
Yeah. And of course, there are relatively modest revenue increases that you could put together on a nationwide scale that would make Social Security solvent in perpetuity. Currently, there's a cap on Social Security. Progressives know this very well. If you're a single filer and you earn $118,000 in income, all of that income is assessed a 2.2% payroll tax. If you earn an extra $118 million in income on top of that, that isn't taxed with the payroll tax rate. Everything above $118,000 is exempt. Some people have talked about raising that cap to $250,000 so you can capture more people. Some people have talked about raising the cap entirely so that you can capture and adequately assess all of the income. But people don't want to do that. What they want to do is cut the benefits instead of funding it better.
And the people you're talking about are not the American public, who overwhelmingly, as Tracy mentioned, not only wants to raise the minimum wage and do other progressive measures like that, but also overwhelmingly opposes cuts to Social Security. And actually, I mean, we've had entire episodes on this.
Right.
The American public overwhelmingly supports expanding Social
yeah.
Security. But the people who are opposed to it are those very serious people
yeah,
with
the conservative policy sphere.
So how are conservatives and pundits reconciling the fact that we, as you've mentioned a couple times already, that we are seeing the economy recover, people are seeing, hey, you know, these measures are working, that unemployment is going down, that we are on track to do better when we have Obamacare, when we have all of these things that they're constantly trying to cut? Is this going to be, do you think, in the election, harder for conservatives to kind of hang their hat on these policies to cut what many Americans are now depending on in favor? Because, you know, just using the Obamacare example, that's something that, you know, a lot of conservatives are talking about. You know, my first day in office, I would cut this. But you've got, you know, millions of Americans who are now dependent on it. How is this going to be a winning strategy for them if they're cutting popular programs?
It's honestly difficult to see where the light is at the end of the tunnel. There's been no reconciliation of the facts. So far, the messaging from conservative media and from the political sphere that feeds off of it has been that, sure, the economy is recovering, but it would recover better if we instituted these conservative policies, if we cut income taxes for the super wealthy, if we allowed corporations to be taxed at territorial tax rates where they can pay all of their corporate income taxes at a rate as if they were from Barbados or Bermuda or some other tax haven internationally. It's the same exact policies that they've been pushing since 1980.
Trickle-down economics, which we know has failed.
Yeah, and there has been no reconciliation with the facts. The argument against Obamacare is probably the easiest one. This is something that has helped almost 30 million Americans directly by either giving them access to health insurance that they were not eligible for previously, by giving them money in their pockets to buy health insurance that they could not afford previously, or by keeping them on plans or expanding the scope of coverage that is available to them. Why would you try to take something away that helps 27 million people? There's no explanation of it.
Ideology is the only one I can come up with.
I was going to go, mwah, ha, ha, ha. I hesitated. I should have dove right in.
Is this the moment for our new segment that Tracy created called In Defense of Trump?
Oh, yeah.
I don't know, but I'm interested.
Well, in defense of Trump, you were able to tweet out a picture of a cat with a similar haircut, and it, I think, improved the moods of the 300-plus people who retweeted it. So the conservative field has that going for it.
Hashtag Trump your cat for our listeners. So,
I think we've gone off the rails.
Craig, where do we go from here? What can we, as a show, what can Media Matters, what can our listeners do to try to combat this misinformation?
Well, I guess the most important thing, media respond to their consumers. Obviously, Fox News continues pushing its misinformative message because its viewers don't care, because they're not consuming contrary information. They're not consuming real research.
They're comforted by getting information that confirms their view of the world already.
Right. But if you're one of the millions of people who's exposed to the USA Today every day, be one of the millions of people who sends them an angry email saying that, you know, that their editorial board published something that is misinformative, that is clearly right-wing conspiracy agenda. They will stop doing these things if people actually care about it. Media Matters has actually led several initiatives to improve the coverage of certain outlets. We helped provide research to an initiative to get the New York Times to provide better context in its budget reporting, and they began improving their coverage of the budget. And when the New York Times improved its quality of reporting, we saw trickle-over effects into the Wall Street Journal and the Washington Post. The Times has this standard-bearing effect. USA Today isn't considered a paper of note, but it is the most widely consumed paper. It doesn't have the same sort of cachet as the Journal and the Post and the Times, but what it does have is readership. And if readers are concerned about the quality of USA Today's coverage of things like Greece and the United States and some sort of ensuing financial catastrophe, they need to make that message loud and clear to USA Today, and that's how you change the quality of coverage.
Where can our listeners find some of the work that you all have been doing?
Well, of course, you can check out Media Matters for America at MediaMatters.org, where we update virtually 24/7, correcting misinformation from both conservative and mainstream media outlets alike. Wherever it bubbles up, we try to push it down. One of our particular interests is things that affect inequality and affect poverty in the United States. Social Security is a perfect example of that. You can't call for cuts to public sector pensions, Social Security, and Medicare and hope to get away with not hurting people who are already poor. And so that's one of the things that we strive to correct is misinformation on those angles. But if you're interested in any of the sort of other issues that we cover, climate, poverty, inequality, LGBT equality, those sorts of things, you can follow our issue teams and our issue directors and our individual researchers. We produce great stuff 24/7, and hopefully you'll check us out.
And a lot of our listeners are on Twitter. Where can they find you, Craig?
They can find me at Craigopedia.
How do you spell Craigopedia?
Well, it's my first name, and then I, and then Pedia. I was told many times that I was an encyclopedia of useless knowledge, and I just decided to own it.
And I'm sure that our listeners who are active on Twitter, when they retweet you, they will understand that the message that you're putting out. It won't be an ironic
and
situation.
They will then also know how to spell Craigopedia.
It's not so difficult.
Craig, thank you so much for joining us for Talk Poverty Radio to talk about Greece, unpack a little bit of why the narratives that have been coming out of that in the media are so dangerous. We look forward to having you back soon.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
You're listening to Talk Poverty Radio on the WEACT Radio Network. I'm Tracy Ross. We're joined by Joan Walsh, editor-at-large for Salon.com and author of What's the Matter with White People? Why We Long for a Golden Age That Never Was. Welcome to the program, Joan.
Thank you so much for having me.
You know, we're fans of Salon. There's a lot going on over there these days. We know that recently you all, the writers, voted unanimously to unionize with the Writers Guild of America. So this is, I know, a very interesting time for you.
Yes, it is.
So just to start out, you've been writing a lot recently about the election. And during the last cycle, you released your book, and in it you argue that the biggest divide in America today is not around party or ideology, but what's to blame for the erosion of the middle class. And what's, you know, funny is that 4 years later, your book is right on target with what politics look like today. Can you explain what the competing explanations are for these two sides that can't agree?
Sure. I mean, and I wish my book wasn't still so relevant, but it really is. You know, I think that the progressive analysis, the Democratic analysis, and in my view, the correct analysis, holds that, you know, the decline of unions, the slashing of taxes, the slashing of the safety net that actually started under Jimmy Carter, to be honest, in the last years of the 70s, really accelerated under Ronald Reagan, that those decisions are to blame for the decline of the middle class. And more than that, the rise of the middle class, which a lot of people, particularly white people, like to think of as something that their ancestors did all on their own. The rise of the American middle class was very much a creation of government. I mean, starting with the New Deal, starting with trying to get out of the Great Depression, starting with, making it easier to organize unions, and then continuing through the war and the post-war period where there was a, you know, great period of expansion of highways. We had the GI Bill. We had the federal government began to insure mortgages so more people could share in homeownership. There was this massive boom in spending with the real intention of sharing prosperity. I think that the twin shocks of the Depression and then the war, fascism and communism, made a lot of people, you know, even Republicans, honestly, it was kind of a bipartisan consensus for years, think that, you know, we need to prevent misery. We have a society that can afford to share affluence, and it leads to stronger capitalism, to be honest. That broke down in the 70s and 80s and 90s, and, you know, we're paying the price. The share of people in unions declined, et cetera. Now, what I really explored in my book is, what's the alternative explanation for all of this? Well, you know, a lot of it has to do with a sense that was cultivated by the Republican Party in the 60s and 70s that liberals had gone too far, that liberals had begun spending like crazy on poverty. The civil rights movement, it did some good things, but it went too far. It moved too fast. The urban riots of the 60s were scary for a lot of people. The unrest around the Vietnam War was scary for a lot of people. I think there was a real sense that that liberals had kind of pushed the envelope and that society was eroding and falling apart. And then specifically, there was a real scapegoating of the poor. There was a real belief that the government had stopped, you know, helping the middle class and had begun, you know, shoveling money to the poor, which we know was never true. But there was a real scapegoating of the poor and a real perception that government was helping people at the expense of the middle class. And I think that persists today. You know, when Donald Trump talks about Mexican immigrants as rapists and criminals, there's this belief that liberals coddle criminals, that people of color are dangerous and have gotten away with too much. And if we could just reverse all those changes of the 60s and 70s, we'd go back to a stable middle-class society.
Well, and since you bring up Donald Trump, and it's hard not to want to talk about Donald Trump, isn't it? you recently put out a piece discussing the role of Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders, actually, at this early stage of the 2016 presidential race. And you wrote, Hillary Clinton can afford to welcome Sanders' candidacy and even endorse a lot of his platform. What do you think is the impact of Sanders' surging popularity, and perhaps even Trump's for that matter, among voters, and in particular white working class voters, and what impact is that going to have on the broader field?
Well, you know, one point that I want to make, I people, especially Sanders supporters, object to lumping the two together, and I certainly don't do it to compare them or to equate them. You know, I think Bernie Sanders represents a noble impulse in the Democratic Party. I mean, he's been outside the party, but now he's coming inside of it. I think that the crowds that he's getting, the excitement he's generating, really shows that the party base is really yearning for answers to economic inequality, to the erosion of the middle class, to all the things we've been discussing, and that they're not, it's hard to red date people. The people who lived through the Cold War, you know, many of them have passed away, and the younger generation isn't scared by the idea that he's a democratic socialist. So I think it's good. I mean, it's been ridiculous for so many of us, and I'm sure you guys agree, when, you know, the right calls Barack Obama a socialist. I mean, he is a centrist, I mean, basically a centrist pro-corporate Democrat, governing in a way that Republicans used to welcome. I'm not, and I don't say that to put him down. He's in a tough position. But, you know, now we have socialism, or real socialism, and it's not scaring people. It makes sense. We're spending too much on college. We stopped expanding public university opportunities, things like that. And so I think, you know, if Hillary Clinton moves toward Bernie Sanders, I think she is not moving away from the center of the country very far. I mean, people are going to make it like Bernie Sanders is a big leftist, but when we see the crowds and we see what he's really talking about, it's not that scary. Now, if the Republicans follow Donald Trump off the deep end, somebody else who's, you know, getting a lot of attention, I mean, he's not pulling out crowds, but somebody else who's kind of surged maybe unexpectedly, if Republicans really try to co-opt his message and go after his supporters, then they're pulling the party farther to the right, and they're going to have a terrible time trying to scramble back to the center. Whoever gets the nomination, if it's not Trump, that person will have a terrible time trying to reach the center and have a real debate with Hillary Clinton or Bernie Sanders, if as the case may be. Let's just leave everything wide open. Nobody's voted yet. So I think he's doing his party a service, and Donald Trump is hurting his party.
But, you know, in defense of Donald Trump, he has had some crowds who just, they were paid actors. That's all. No?
That's true. I don't think, you know, I don't think Bernie Sanders is paying people to show up in Madison. And yeah. No, that's a good point, though.
Tracy, we may need to start a regular segment on the show that starts with "In defense of Donald." It can be a challenge for our guests.
See how often I can finish that sentence. So, but one thing that has been somewhat comforting, at least to our show, is that poverty has increasingly been in conversations on the national stage, and we're hoping that it's going to be infused throughout the 2016 election. Do you think that poverty is an issue that would resonate with voters, especially since, you know, a lot of people think of themselves as middle class?
Yeah, you know, that's always been the challenge for those of us who care about poverty and you know, watch politicians frame their programs and their pitch to the middle class, and you know, having a hard time talking about the working class, let alone poor people. Increasingly, though, we know that poor people are working class. You know, we've got such a high proportion of people working and yet also receiving public benefits because their salaries are too low. So I think there's a greater understanding that, you know, the poor are not people layabouts and slackers. But increasingly, they really are people trapped in the low-wage economy, you know, sometimes accepting welfare, even though they're working full-time. There seems to be a little bit more of a perception of that. On the negative side, some of the talk about poverty, quite honestly, is being driven by Republicans trying to embarrass President Obama and trying to say that, you know, to blame President Obama for the persistence of poverty in our society and for the fact that the poor, nobody shared in the gains of the, quote, recovery, except the top 1%. I mean, the middle class hasn't shared, let alone the poor. So, you know, there's a real, you start to hear this astounding rhetoric from people like Ted Cruz, but they're really just doing it to jam Obama, and they like to bring up African-American poverty in particular, not to do anything about it, but to embarrass the president. So some of the rhetoric is really, you know, completely dishonest and disingenuous.
And something that you've written about extensively over the years is the concept of the undeserving or the immoral poor. And, you know, this is something we've seen reflected in really a whole spate of laws across states that prevent people from spending public assistance on steak and seafood, on, you know, cruise ships.
On spaghetti sauce.
Spaghetti sauce, right? We have some unintended consequences in those bills, too. And then, of course, there's the trend of drug testing for TANF and food stamps. Why do you think that the narrative of the so-called undeserving poor exists? And does it have anything to do with how many Americans are feeling the squeeze themselves?
I think there's some of that. I think it is people, you know, like I said before, the narrative that took over in the 60s and 70s and 80s was that the government was now giving your tax dollars to those people. And it was happening, or this perception was spreading as wages were stagnating and then declining for working people. So even though what they thought was happening wasn't exactly happening that way, they were feeling the pinch, and they weren't seeing anything coming along to help them. Of course, scapegoating the poor doesn't help them either. So that's kind of complicated.
But maybe it makes them feel better.
Well, I think there is some of that. I mean, you know, of course there's a racial element to this, but there was a lot of, you know, I explore in my book the similarities between the way Irish Catholic immigrants were treated in the 19th century and even the early 20th century to the way African Americans have been treated. And there's, you know, there's lots of evidence in the 19th century that, you know, there were reformers and, quote, missionaries within the inner city slums who thought that, you know, Black people were being hurt and contaminated by their close association with you know, lazy, drunken, sexualized Irish Catholics. All the stereotypes, virtually everything that's ever been said about African Americans was said about Irish Catholics in the 19th century. So, you know, there's a long history of fearing the newcomer, as much as we're a nation of immigrants, of fearing a lot of newcomers, of believing that they are infecting us with some dread disease and not, you know, fit to carry on American values. And then gradually those newcomers become, quote, white, and then they start poking their finger at somebody, at African Americans and Latinos. So it becomes racialized. It becomes black brown versus white, but it used to be white against white. So it's got deep roots in the society.
So speaking of the racialized nature of these types of conversations, you know, it's hard to, I think, in one hand, acknowledge the fact that African Americans are disproportionately poor, but avoid the making African Americans the face of poverty. And that, you know, we see with the image of the welfare queen in the 80s and even Paul Ryan's use of inner city men. How do you think we can have conversations about poverty and race that are more productive?
I think that's really a paradox that many of us struggle with. And I'm not sure I know the way out of it, but I think, you know, one thing that does happen is when we argue that most people who are on public assistance are white, it can be helpful. We need to remember that. But we also, I think that we lost our capacity. I think we're getting it back, but we really lost our capacity to explain the legacy, not just of slavery and Jim Crow, but of kind of embedded racism, the ways that, you know, redlining and neighborhood covenants that prevented blacks from owning homes in better neighborhoods created the wealth gap, that we really have a way of explaining the real policy, not just the, you know, individual, I don't like black people part of it, that's not good, but also, you know, the state sanctioned discrimination and separation that has kept African-Americans from joining, many African-Americans from joining the rest of society and taking advantage of these opportunities. I think, you know, the conversation around this legacy of, you know, ingrained discrimination is really important. And when we try to make sure that poverty doesn't have a black face, for lots of important reasons, but we can't lose sight of the special, the long ingrained history of African American poverty, the way it persists, the way it if people wind up isolated in concentrated pockets of poverty, and the ways out are not as obvious to them as they might be even to the white poor, who themselves have it very hard. Let's be honest, it's not easy being poor, no matter what your race is.
Well, and a follow-up question is, you know, over the past couple of years, there's been a broader national conversation around race relations in the United States that has largely been driven by discussions around police brutality, most recently the shooting, the tragic, horrible shooting at the AME church in Charleston, South Carolina. Something that you often write about and speak about is that white people can be allies in racial justice issues and conversations. How do you see your role in that respect, and what do you think makes a good ally?
You know, I think one thing that makes a good ally is making sure you do a lot more listening than talking. You know, when we're speaking of white allies in the struggle for racial justice, you know, I think that I have had to learn lessons over and over. I've had to learn new lessons. I've had to understand, gradually come to understand people's perspective, changing perspectives, changing ways that we talk about race and things that make people, you know, newly uncomfortable over and over again. But, you know, I also think it's important, that the coalitions be broad, and therefore I think, you know, we need to have a conversation about white allies, and also make sure that they don't act entitled, and make sure that they sort of understand that it often really is a great idea to defer to leadership of color, all those things. I also think, though, we've got to, you know, maybe make it easier for people to be allies and be a little bit more forgiving of missteps. I mean, there's just, if you're new to the conversation around racial justice, now we can say nobody should be new to that. Everyone should care. The fact of the matter is, sadly, most white people don't. Not because they're bad people necessarily, but because it hasn't impacted their lives. They don't have black friends. They don't grow up thinking about this stuff. When they have occasion to suddenly be concerned about it, which is a good thing, you know, people make mistakes. People say dumb things on Twitter. I'm not talking about Paula Deen here. You know what I mean? But, oh, boy. I think that we've got to have some patience and think about how we bring people along and, you know, understand that people aren't going to get it right away either and not look for ways to push people away, which, you know, sometimes I see in social media just immediately, you know, barring the door because somebody asks a stupid question or uses the wrong terminology. Mm-hmm. I think we have to be more forgiving about that. Maybe it's not my place to say we have to forgive, but, you know, just as an observer, I think it would help bring more people along.
Our guest is Joan Walsh, editor-at-large for Salon.com. Thanks so much for joining our conversation today.
Oh, my pleasure.
You're listening to Talk Poverty Radio on the WEACT Radio Network. I'm Tracy Ross. I'm joined by Liz Benishai,
senior policy analyst on the job quality team at the Center for Law and Social Policy. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So we've had a number of guests on our show that have mentioned unstable work schedules in passing and how they undermine the success of workers. But can you unpack this for us?
Sure. What we're finding is for a lot of workers, particularly in low-wage jobs, it's not just low wages themselves, but the way their schedules are structured that really make it difficult to make ends meet and to balance other aspects of their lives. So many workers are receiving very few days notice of when they'll be working, whether that's just a few days or even a week. Many experience last-minute changes to their schedules, just within hours of when they're supposed to be working. Some are placed on call so that they don't know whether they'll be working or getting a paycheck, you know, at the end of the day. A whole range of practices that make their schedules and then ultimately their lives really unstable. So particularly for workers who have childcare obligations or who are juggling a second job, as so many low-wage workers are, these kinds of scheduling practices just make it very difficult to get by.
And so earlier this week, it was introduced in the House and in the Senate, the Schedules That Work Act. Can you explain what measure this legislation would put into place?
Sure. So this federal bill would try to address some of the issues that I mentioned. The bill has two parts, and the first part applies to workers in all industries with employers that employ more than 15 people. And that would give workers what we call the right to request some kind of scheduling accommodation. So even though that seems like a relatively straightforward thing, many workers are afraid to ask their employers to give them more predictable or stable schedules, and this bill would protect them against retaliation for asking. And for workers who fall into some kind of high-priority categories like workers with caregiving obligations, workers with serious illnesses of their own, workers who have a second job or are in a job training program, the employer would be obligated to try to accommodate their request unless there was some bona fide business reason for not doing so. For workers that are in the building, cleaning, retail, and food service industries, there are some additional provisions. Those are some industries that we know are particularly bad on these issues. Those workers would get at least 2 weeks' notice of their schedules, and they would be compensated for last-minute changes to their schedule, being sent home early from work, or being on call or having to work a split shift. This bill also gives the Secretary of Labor the power to add additional industries to that second half of the bill if there is sufficient evidence, as detailed in the legislation, to warrant that kind of measure. So that's kind of the broad overview of the bill.
And you've written that volatile scheduling is not just bad for workers, but it's bad for business. Can you explain how, you know, first, if it's bad for business, why is this becoming the norm? And two, how would these changes improve the business climate?
Sure. So, you know, we often kind of see this issue in the media as pitting workers against employers or businesses, and as though their interests are you know, in conflict. But we know from a growing body of research that treating workers in this kind of unfair way that creates a lot of chaos in their lives also leads to high rates of turnover, lower rates of productivity, and less efficiency on the sales floor in the retail kind of environment. And employers that do provide stability and predictability to their workers find that they're able to retain higher quality employees for longer periods of time, and turnover is really quite a costly thing that, you know, some employers may not be aware of how much it's costing them, but I think increasingly we're seeing that employers do want to retain their employees for longer periods of time, even in industries that are known to be high turnover. So another aspect is that, in fact, the predictability of labor needs is much higher than many employers assume. So sometimes the kinds of changes that they're making at the last minute are really unnecessary, and there's a, sort of logistically a lot of reason to provide more stability. So we've talked to many employers who are giving their employees more notice, providing them with more input into their schedules, finding that it really does pay off when it comes to the bottom line. So we think this kind of legislation can also motivate employers to do what's really in their own interest.
But, you know, based off of what you've said already, if I were a business owner and you're saying that this will be good for morale, good for my business, that seems like incentive enough to do that. Why aren't more businesses already doing it on their own? It seems odd to employ tactics or strategies that undermine your business.
Yeah, I mean, I think many of them are not thinking about this in the long term. You know, we see this in other areas of our job quality work, like paid sick days and paid family leave, that, you know, there's this sort of subset of employers that really do recognize the benefits, but unfortunately, others are stuck in the mentality that, you know, labor is just a cost, and it needs to be, that cost needs to be reduced as much as possible, rather than thinking about employees as a key kind of asset that needs to be maximized. They're just thinking about it in a framework that isn't very effective. And that's exactly why we need public policies and can't really just rely on employers to, you know, do what's best for themselves and their workers. These public policy initiatives that we're seeing, not just at the federal level, but now being proposed in many states around the country, they're really necessary to move the ball on this issue.
So we know that recently that the Obama administration put out some rules or new policy around overtime. And Robert Reich wrote an interesting piece for Salon talking about how every time there's a new policy to improve job quality, you get lots of business leaders coming out saying that this is going to harm the economy, and it doesn't really play out that way. So, but if we have, a whole suite of policies, you mentioned paid leave. Do you think that there's an argument that, you know, to play devil's advocate, that if we have paid leave and these schedule changes and fair wages, that are we putting too much pressure on businesses?
I don't think so. I mean, many of these policies just go hand in hand with an overarching approach to running your business in a way that is smart, basically. So, you know, ultimately, most of these measures are not costly to employers. So, while it makes sense to say, you know, they're just kind of layering one on top of the other, and it's going to be so costly, and the sky is going to fall, if you take the perspective that each one is going to be, you know, a major cost to employers, when you really look at the evidence and talk to employers who are doing all of these things, they don't find it to be costly. They find it to be cost effective. So, you know, I think it's really just a question of framing it and the mentality. And, you know, as Robert Reich says, the evidence pretty much always comes out in favor of the argument that it's good business sense to create a fair workplace.
We often hear how working a low wage job is accompanied by very low bargaining power. How is the role of grassroots movement, such as we've seen with, you know, fast food workers organizing for higher wages, how is that shaping this debate?
Yeah, absolutely. We're seeing a lot of really amazing worker activism that has pushed this issue into the public eye. Walmart workers have been leaders on this issue and have been able to motivate Walmart to make some promises to improve worker schedules. We've seen it with many retail workers working with the Retail Action Project, a lot of groups around the country that are mobilizing and taking that message that, you know, we need higher wages, but we also need better working conditions all around, to the streets and to the public eye. I think it's having a huge impact.
Our guest is Liz Benishai, Senior Policy Analyst on the Job Quality Team at the Center for Law and Social Policy. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And that's our show. Thanks for listening to Talk Poverty Radio on the We Act Radio Network.
And continue the conversation with us on Twitter using the hashtag TalkPoverty and tweet directly at us with the handle @TalkPoverty.
Special thanks, as always, go out to our co-executive producers, Alyssa Peterson and Greg Kaufman. Also the press team and the poverty team.
And as always, our friend, Chris Stiles Bacon.
Take it away, Chris Stiles.
I work and get paid like minimum wage. Sights to hit the clock by the end of the day. Hop from downtown into the hood where I stay. The only place I can't afford cause my block ain't safe. I spend most of my time working trying to bring in the dough. And none of those could connect me with the HMO. And nowadays it's common for grandparents to outlive their grandkids. And those are the type of odds that we handle. I'm not a slave to a man with a whip. I'm a slave to the U.S. men. And they got me doing things in my life that never made any sense. But it paid me in dollars and cents. I need the money for the food, the health care, the schools and bus fare. You can't pay the rent without the U.S. right there. With shackles on my hands and toes, they got a brother moving slow, but my soul is determined to go. I want freedom, freedom. Now I don't know where it's at, but it's calling me back. I feel my spirit is revealing the map. We just trying to get freedom. What we talking about?